Hey everybody, welcome back to the Booterverse. I'm sitting here with comedian Stuart Huff. Stuart, it's great to have you on the show.
Thank you very much for having me. We've tried to schedule this a couple times and I'm glad it worked out.
You are like that hard to get date, but I finally landed my whale, my friend. I'm the Ahab of podcasters.
You're the first human to ever say I'm a hard to get date. I love it. It feels good.
It should feel good. You are like my white whale. You're always there. You're in the ether, but I can never find you. I have you here.
Right. It's right here. I'm wrapped up with ropes.
Now, Stuart, I was doing a little research, as we do, and you were born in Kentucky, moved to Tennessee, now live in Georgia. You just keep moving south. Are you going to be living in Havana anytime soon?
I have never been to Havana, but I would love to have been in Havana in the 50s. What a great time that would have been. I've actually moved. I've lived in North Carolina at one point, in Los Angeles at one point. I've lived in Louisville a couple different times. The bio seems like I'm going south, but I've bounced around quite a bit.
Listen, Stuart, I only do the abridged version of people's bios. So to me, I just set up the narrative and we run with it.
Stuart Huff, male. Yeah. Boom. Done.
Seeking podcast host to be on said podcast.
Perfect.
It is perfect. Now, sir, how long have you been in the comedy biz?
I'm bad with years. I think 20 years.
I think that's right. I think that's what my producer said. She said at least 2 decades. At least.
Yeah. So, I don't know why it is. Numbers do not stick in my head. Birth dates, even my birth date. If I'm not around someone who goes, happy birthday, I'll forget it. Dates, numbers, not mathematical guy.
But words are your thing, sir. How do you craft your material? What's your process?
I find something interesting, something that makes me excited first. And then usually what I do is I walk. That's the actual literal process. Like I have to move. I have to walk. I can't sit in front of a computer and type it out. I walk in paces around. I have a circle in my backyard that grass won't grow because I just literally walk in circles and I talk out loud like a psychopath. I'll just start. You know, 1691, Lucilio Vanini, an Italian philosopher. Can you imagine being alive? And just talk and talk and talk. And then when I say something that I like, I stop. I make a little note to myself, and then I keep talking. So after a period of 4 or 5 hours, I have a long list of things that I like. Sentences, thoughts, ideas, words. Maybe it's just one word. Maybe it's like, I like pausing here. Whatever it is. I have a page full of things I like, and then I have something, and then I can take that, sit at a desk, look at these ideas, and craft something.
Boom.
Yeah, that tends to be, and it took me a long time to figure out that's my method, you know?
Well, it seems to be a bit unconventional from the way you hear other people talking about how they do comedy, in terms of writing and coming up with ideas. But, as a little side note, that's how I do it as well.
Oh, really?
It's true. I just start talking, and it just, because that's that free flow, that wonderful, it just, you know, and I come up with stuff and I'm like, where did this come from? How did this pop into my head or out of my head?
Yeah, I think, I kind of think of it as more like exactly what you said, like it's in there. Let my brain just work without my personality getting in its way. Just let it flow.
Absolutely. You know? Now, after 20 years, that still worked for you, but we talked a little bit about but how do you think the comedy scene is changing or may change in the future?
I could be wrong about this, but what I see observationally is the younger comics are doing so much more interesting comedy. And that's not all across the board. I'm not talking about every one of them, but the majority of them are really unique, really interesting. They're tackling topics that might be considered too controversial for a club, and I'm not even talking about dirty topics. Just, you know, comic books. You see guys talking; they'll do an entire set on comic books, where a standard, quote unquote, standard comedy club audience on a first show Friday night, they're not going to listen to 12 minutes of comic book humor, but in the back of a bar, you know, they will, and they'll get it and they'll like it. It seems to be there's an uprising coming from beneath that I think in 10 years' time will take out the bigger clubs. I think they'll be gone.
Do you think this is because of sort of the niche market that the millennials seem to appreciate and enjoy, where you don't have to pander or make broad swaths in terms of your material, but you can actually hit a niche market and do humor for that group of people.
I think that's definitely part of it. You can actually, you know, advertise. You can wonderful podcasts, you know, or advertisement. You can get on the internet. You can say, I'm going to do my comic book show at the back of this bar on Thursday night, and you can draw people that want to see that instead of this wide net. Let's just get 200 people in the club and then expect the comedian to make everybody happy. You know, now you can target certain groups. So I think it's opening up possibilities for young comics to actually express who they are. You know, this is who I am. This is what I like. This is, you know, so you don't have to be as broad as you said, you know, and that's the reason historically sex jokes, drug jokes, drinking jokes, that's the majority of comedy because everybody knows about those things. Well, now you can get into talking about something extremely detailed, which makes it so much more interesting.
It does. And I think it brings out this notion that humor exists in these very minute places that oftentimes never get explored. Do you think we'll have big, broad comedians like we used to have, Pryor, Carlin, those sort of comedians that were watershed figures anymore?
That's a very good question. If I had to put $50, which is a substantial sum of money compared to my annual income, if I had to put $50 on this, I would say that your standard comedy club, your 300 to 400 seat comedy club in 10 years is not going to be around, or at least there might be 3 or 4 of them left in the entire country, which is what there was in the 70s, by the way, before the boom, you know. It's going to be smaller venues. It's going to be 70 seaters, 100 seaters, things like that, you know.
And it's going to be that niche marketing.
It's
going to
be a niche marketing.
Hey, I'm coming to your city. Come and see me.
Yes.
You know, on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, whatever, however individuals reach their audience.
Right.
Now, have you found that your generation of comedian has found it difficult to interface with the new social media marketing in the sense that that's now how many younger comedians are reaching their audience?
Yeah, most of us have found it extremely, extremely difficult. Even people that think they're doing a good job, like, well, I put it on Facebook. That's not enough. That's not, I mean, to someone who's really into social media, Facebook is just the very start of it, getting really detailed and down into stuff. I'm bad at it, but I'm trying to learn how to get better at it, because what's ended up happening to me, I'm happy about this, but I've always been a weird comedian. You know, I've always been strange. And in the year 2000, then I was really weird. I was going up on stage in front of 300 people that had babysitters and talking about, you know, strange topics that they'd never heard of and trying to make them funny. And they were like, what's going on? The other comics wouldn't even talk to me. I was so weird, you know?
Wow.
And
but,
now,
but I'm talking to you, though. So
right.
that should bolster your self-esteem.
Yes, absolutely. But now what's happened is now that I've been stubborn and I refuse to do material I don't like just to please the crowd. So my stubbornness is now in this new, what I consider the new comedy world, which is I can go to a town in a small venue and I can advertise I'm a Southern liberal who's going to do interesting philosophy-based comedy. Well, I can draw 50 people, not 300, but 50. And that's enough for a small venue, you know?
Now, you are on the road some, what was it, 48 weeks a year, something crazy like that?
Yeah, I've for the last at least decade, I've probably averaged anywhere from 46 to 50.
Now, can I call you a roadie?
Oh, yeah, I'm a road cop. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Definitely.
You're there.
I hate flying. Last year, I did 48 weeks, I think, and I flew once, drove all the other ones, because that's part of my writing, too. I need to be in the car. I need to be moving. You know, I need to see a sign and think something. I need to pull over and go into a weird restaurant and eavesdrop on people's conversations and listen to what people are saying and what people are wearing and doing. I don't want to be on a plane with headphones in thinking about my own life. I want to be looking at other people.
Now, when you were younger, did you find the traditional way of learning difficult? In the sense that you're behind a desk, you're sitting down, you're having to listen and just kind of...
I was bored to death. I was so bored. My junior year of high school, this is not an exaggeration, I made straight F's my junior year of high school. Sophomore year, I think I had two B's and the rest were A's, but I was so bored, I just gave up. I was like, I don't care anymore. Like English class, I had already read the books that were required reading. I just didn't show up for the test. I just didn't care. So I made straight F's. So my senior year of high school, my counselor told me that I had to make straight A's just to graduate.
Wow.
Yeah. So that, and so I had to, so I did, you know, but I was so bored. I think education has got to change. That, to me, that's my biggest sticking point on stage. I talk about it every night. Every show I do, the last two CDs, last three CDs I've put out have some sort of bit about education on them.
Why that topic? I mean, just, you know, what about it gravitates you toward it?
I think every social issue we're dealing with, if it couldn't be fixed by education, it could definitely be helped by education. I think freedom without intelligence is dangerous.
Now, some people would tell you that we've done too good of a job at educating the populace just enough, but not enough to actually have them be productive members of society in a way that could actually change things for the better. We're just educating them to a base minimum, mm-hmm. and yet not actually pushing them over that edge to where they could actually use that education to
their own
betterment.
I think that's fascinating. I haven't heard that argument, but I don't, right off the top of my head, I don't think I would disagree with it. I think the education system is 100 years behind, maybe 50 years behind at least. I mean, you look at what we have, like we're teaching kids, you know, information, which at one point was needed. I mean, at one point, the idea that there was a building in your town where someone had books, are you kidding? You know, you go back to like 1650, the only books that existed were rich people, the king, and the pope. That was it. So you didn't even have access to information. And now there's going to be a building where you could send your kids and someone's going to open a book and tell them something that's in it. Well, that is no longer the case. You can look up anything on your phone. Are you curious? Did we have a president that was elected into the KKK on the White House lawn? You can find out right now. All you got to do is type it into your phone. You can find out how many atomic weapons are sitting on the bottom of the ocean floor that someone just accidentally dropped from a plane. You want to know? You can find out right now.
Do you know the answer to that question?
Right 11. Now? Yeah.
Well, Jacques Cousteau, if you're out there, for yeah. God's sake, find those and get them away yeah. from my hair.
And by the way, let's link this because this would be interesting. I became interested in that and learned that because I was driving through a back road in South Carolina and there was a historical marker, right? And it said atomic weapon. And I went, what was that? So I actually turned around, parked, and read the marker. There are two atomic bombs off the coast of South Carolina on the ocean floor. I mean,
well, that's comforting.
Yeah. I mean, they're, you know, according to the marker, and I sat in my car and researched it, they're not going to explode. They've gone down there and done whatever, but they're still there. They exist. They're just lying there on the.
Just hanging out.
But see, I learned that on my phone sitting on the back road in South Carolina. So what's the point of teaching kids facts anymore? I think what we need to do now is inspire them to want to learn. And as soon as you do that, the internet will take care of itself. You know?
I'm just worried now, Stuart, because of a disgruntled jellyfish that might go down there and start pushing some buttons. You know what I mean?
That is true. And there's a part of me that wouldn't blame him.
No. I mean, at this point, he's going to ride that wave. I mean, you know what I mean? A little nuclear blast under the ocean.
I mean,
boom.
He's just trying to be a jellyfish. He's floating around. There's probably coolers and toilet seat lids everywhere.
He's doing what he does. Yeah.
You know, he's angry and can't really blame him. I'm against jellyfish violence, but I don't blame jellyfish violence. Mm.
Have you ever pissed on somebody's leg when somebody was stung by a jellyfish to help them out?
I have not. Have you?
Not that I remember.
Not that you remember.
I'm sure I've probably pissed on someone's leg.
Is that a thing? Is that a thing
that
people say?
Oh, that's a thing,
say?
Stuart. That's what they do.
Is that right?
That's what lifeguards are trained to do on the beaches of our great nation.
See, that's fantastic.
See, you didn't know that.
Is there any kind of scientific factual background for that?
Absolutely not.
Really? So someone's just yelling and you kind of piss on them.
Absolutely.
Say, hey, be quiet. I'll piss on you. You'll be all right.
Which I imagine is like being in some of the comedy clubs you've actually played.
Mm.
Now, is it true that you've been punched in the face at least twice while on stage?
No, once on stage.
And the other?
Offstage, a guy and the bouncer of the club, by the way, both kicked my butt pretty bad. I was actually on the floor in a fetal position, and this guy was kicking me in the back, right? And I saw through my, slit of my fingers, I saw the bouncer coming towards me, and I thought, okay, he's going to stop him. And then the bouncer came over and started kicking my legs.
Now, Stuart, what did you do?
I went into a redneck bar in the middle of, an area, and I gave them all my opinions, and they showed me that they did not agree with my opinions.
Well, they showed you how they deal with people who disagree with
exactly.
their opinions.
Exactly. And that's how they took care of that. The one that I was punched in the face was Macon, Georgia.
And I've been on that 75 corridor, my friend.
Okay.
All the way
yeah.
to Savannah.
Yeah.
That's where my people go.
So my sister and her partner, I donated sperm to them so they could have a baby.
Look at you. You're a giver.
Yeah.
I love that about
yeah.
you.
Yeah. And I was telling the story on stage in Macon, Georgia. And a guy came up on stage and punched me in the face. Yeah.
Did he wish that he would have been able to donate?
Well,
is that why he was mad?
You tend to look at things in the positive view, and I respect that about you.
I'm a positive thinker. People know that. Positive
if I
column.
Had another $50, which I don't, to bet on it, I would say that's not where he was coming from.
Mm-hmm. Perhaps he believed that you were doing something that was an affrontation to his Lord and Savior.
I believe that was more of the tunnel that he was running down.
Mm. And I bet he's the kind of gentleman that would use the word affrontation to describe how bad he felt about it.
I'm sure that's common, yeah, in his vocabulary.
I'll tell you what, Stuart, you can't come down here and talk about stuff like that. You know what I mean? You got to keep it to tractor trailers generally, and sometimes a good RV joke, we like them. But I'll tell you what, you start making fun of the stars and bars and, moonshine, I'll tell you what, we're going to get you.
That you sound like a typical front row for a lot of my shows.
Well, I'll tell you what, Stuart, I like seeing you because what you do is you challenge the status quo. And I like that. I like that.
Now,
about
that
you.
Is, yeah, I do occasionally have something like that, which I love. I do. I'm not kidding. I had a guy, I'll tell this story. This was in Indianapolis, right? And I was toying around with this idea that several people had told me that they hate Mexicans because they're dirty. And it's such a weird thing. So I'd had 4 or 5 people within a 2-year span tell me this. And I always said the same thing. I'm open-minded. Convince me. How are they dirty? Convince me. And everybody said the same thing. There's always like 20 of them living in one apartment. And I'm like, well, that's not, I wouldn't call that dirty. I call that taking care of each other. And then I ask the crowd. I'd say, be honest with me. Have you ever seen a homeless Hispanic person? And I just let it sit for a couple of seconds. And it's, I think in the year I did this joke, I think I had 3 people that had seen a homeless Hispanic person. 2 in Orlando and 1 in Texas. So they're rare. And I just let that sit for a minute. And then I say, it seems to me the Hispanic population of Indianapolis, there should be some homeless Hispanic people. I don't know why they're not there. But my first guess is they take care of each other. They allow each other to live in their places when they don't have a place. So one night I do this joke on stage, right? And there's a guy, huge, big man, a lot of tattoos, big, huge kind of. And he took his fist and punched the table. He punched and everybody freaked out. A glass broke, And he goes, damn it, you're right. And I was like, oh, it was so worth it, It's worth getting punched in the face in Macon. To occasionally have someone come up to me and go, I don't really like what you say, but you might be right about some of that stuff.
Well, I'll tell you what, Stuart, I'm just looking at your long hair right there, your hippy-dippy haircut, and I'll tell you what, you're speaking some truth, and I like that about you. It's a good time. Now, do you find it different to do comedy in the North than in the South when it comes to the material that you're doing?
No, my personal opinion, and this is something that shocked me before I started getting out and traveling, my personal opinion is I don't believe there's that much difference in people in Oregon or in, Mississippi. I don't believe there's a whole lot of difference. If you get into a smaller town in a bar, they're going to be closed-minded. They're going to be aggressive and angry, You go into a bigger city, what's the difference between Minneapolis and say Birmingham. You know, if you're in the right venue, they're the same people. You know, it to me, I don't really even think of the South anymore as anything other than an accent. You know, but that angry attitude, that kind of, you know, if I say something that challenges your belief system and you're going to retaliate with violence, I don't think that's restricted to the South. You know,
and it's funny to me. It's great for me to see someone who is approaching social issues and doing so with humor and hopefully with respect, and saying, "Hey, I disagree with you, but here's another viewpoint. It's going to be funny." Why can't people laugh at themselves and their viewpoints anymore?
I don't know. It's so interesting. That what you just said is exactly what my new show is about. It's exactly what it's about. You know, George Bernard Shaw said, if you're going to tell people the truth, you better make them laugh or they'll kill you. You know.
He also said, pass the opium.
And both things, I think, are pertinent.
I don't know if George Bernard Shaw was an opiate addict. I don't know that.
I'd never heard that, but it, you know.
I'm going to make up history here on the Buddha.
That's a good thing to do, I think. It's fascinating to me. I sat down on a plane. This is a new joke in my act, but it's true. It's totally true. I sat down on a plane. The guy next to me opened the paper, and the science section of the paper, right? The headline said, flooding in Texas, global warming related, ? And this guy started going off, saying hilarious stuff. He was like, look at this. Every single dollar we've ever spent on science is wasted. They've never done anything for anybody ever. And he's going on and on and on about his hatred for science. Never done anything for anybody ever. And I'm sitting there thinking, we're on a plane. Are you kidding? How can you not just observe the world around you? Never done anything for anybody ever. It's crazy. I don't understand anger towards a scientific discovery. It makes no sense to me. Happiness, sadness, bored, confused, all these other emotions are fine. Angry? Like, you can't say that's a table. The hell it is! You know? What is that?
Well, Stuart, again, I'm going to have to disconnect you there from that idea, because what you're talking about there is a four-legged thing, but to call it a table, that's deep. You know what I mean? I don't know. It's interesting to me that we are simultaneously making progress, and on one side there's unhappiness, but even with any progress that's being made, good or bad, because progress doesn't necessarily mean good.
Right, absolutely.
But there is still anger on any side.
Mm-hmm.
Gay marriage was just passed.
Right.
Obviously, individuals who don't believe that the government should institute that as a legal civil institute are upset. Okay, fine.
Okay.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
But instead of rejoicing because of progress that had been made on the other side, I see just as much vitriol as there was before coming from each side, even though one side would seem to be better off now than they were just, you know, a week ago.
Yeah, here's an interesting thing, and I don't know the answer to this. I'm popping this up. I'm just, here it is. I'm throwing this out of my mouth, open for any kind of retort. Taking a much wider view, okay, much wider, historical view. Right now, we have a lot of anger going on. We have a lot of arguments. We have a lot of people that, all this, you know. I think that is the greatest thing that the idea of America, okay, the United States of America, that's what this country should be known for, is it allows an argument to happen. In 1400, it wasn't possible for peasants to argue about gay marriage and then eventually make a choice and change their lives. It wasn't even possible. 1791, Bill of Rights was ratified. It made it possible for all of us to argue and fight about the Confederate flag. And eventually, we will come to enough of a consensus and make and change things or keep things. Is it possible that in and of itself, the argument, the fighting, because isn't an argument just the start of a solution?
Absolutely.
You agree with that?
I do. And if we can still respect, I think here's the caveat.
Yeah,
if we can still respect someone, even though they differ with us, that's where the rubber meets the road for me.
I agree. And that, to me, that's where education comes in. You have to at least be intelligent enough to respect the person across from you, to have compassion for their point of view, and to at least have enough self-awareness to know that you aren't always right. So if you introduce intelligence into an argument, it takes away the violent reactions, it takes away the church burnings, takes away the anger and the murder, and then you can have a decent argument and all of us come to a consensus on something.
Right.
I think maybe that's the greatest thing the United States of America has allowed, is an argument.
And here's the thing, even if you don't agree, for mm-hmm. example, with something like gay marriage,
right.
if you're not gay, you don't have to participate. You neither mm-hmm. have to go to a church that might now sanction that, nor do you have to get gay married
right.
in a civil union, in a civil ceremony.
Right.
You don't have to, nobody's forcing me to gay marry you. As far as I know.
As far as you know.
But Stuart, but you are
also,
my white whale.
You also whale. Said pass the opiates. So, you know.
I'm just saying that's what George Bernard Shaw said.
Right.
I just quote history. Sir.
Yes, you do.
Speaking of quoting history, is it good enough to just erase it? And I'm going to make an argument, and I want to hear where you're coming down on this.
Okay.
So in Germany,
mm-hmm.
can't get a copy of Mein Kampf.
Right.
You know, Nazi flags, obviously, very prohibited.
I think they're illegal, right?
And illegal. Right,
yeah.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
Now, does that mean the Nazi Party isn't alive and well in Germany?
Nope.
No, it's there.
It's there.
It's all over Europe and even here in America.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If we take down the Confederate battle flag
mm-hmm.
from, let's say, a state flag like South Carolina,
mm-hmm.
okay. But does that really solve the problem?
You and I think the same. We absolutely do. I think that the Confederate flag should be removed from state buildings for one reason, because it lost. Why would you fly a flag that lost on the winner's building?
But Stuart, you're from the South, 100 years after, you know, the loss of the Confederacy.
I think it should be taken down from state buildings simply because it lost. You know, it's the side of, you know, of the two flags, one of them lost and one won. And I don't think, but I'm completely against restricting it from anybody's personal space. You want to put a bumper sticker on your truck, you want to fly the flag in your front yard. I'm for it because of this reason. I don't believe restriction is the answer to the problem. I don't believe it actually fixes anything. I'm against restriction of language, any of it. You know, in the Prohibition, we made alcohol legal and gave the mob a tremendous amount of power, and everybody still drank. And there's some drugs that are illegal, and they're impossible to find. I mean, I just don't think we can admit now that restricting something, banning something, making it illegal doesn't actually work, you know? So I'm against forcing someone to take the Confederate flag down from their front yard. I believe education is going to be the answer.
Well, I'll tell you what, Stuart, these colors don't run. You know, they might fade a little bit on the back of my F-150, but they do not run. That's what I have to say about that.
Well, they sure ran a lot during the war.
Well, I'll tell you what, we're still sore about that General Sherman guy. I tell you what, he sped through Atlanta faster than a guy in a Corvette from a titty bar. You know what I'm talking about? It's a crazy time. Well, now, Stuart, we have gone very deep into some social issues right now. Let's go a little lighter. Let's get a little bit more surfacey, shall we?
Okay.
Who cuts your hair?
Anybody that's near me. When it gets in my eyes and starts to bug me.
Do you find that men have a singular approach to hair? And this is what it is. We wake up one morning mm-hmm. and we have a single thought. My hair is too long. It must be cut. And that day, or until we can get it cut, it is the single thing on our minds.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And my hair, I actually cared about my hair at one point, but it's so horrible that now, for the last decade, all I want it to do is get out of my face. Don't be annoying. That's all I want it to do.
Get out of my face. Don't be annoying. So basically, you treat your hair like a sorority girl.
Hey, perfect. Perfect. I do not understand this obsession that men have with younger girls. I I'm talking younger, like 16, 18, you know, that kind. Just annoying. That's what I think. Annoying. I thought that when I was 18. Are we still surface? Do I have a tendency to bring things down
you
to
know,
a point?
Stuart, you are like an anchor, sir. Yeah, you are steady and true, and you will find that bottom wherever it goes.
Yes, I will. I'm a dead white whale, is what I am.
Listen, you are like one of those whales that washed up on the beach and people tried to save it. And you're like, no, I'm beached now. This is my home. And you end up being, you know, sort
Isn't
of fodder.
It strange
for
that I would
candles.
Be attracted to comedy. I'm not funny. I'm funny is the last thing on my resume. I don't know why I was ever attracted to this, you know?
It was the women.
You think so? It was the three I've had in 20 years.
Well, Stuart, that's better than some people do.
Right. I could have gotten that working at the bank. I mean, why didn't I do something with more income?
I just assumed you didn't want to wear matching uniforms with everyone else.
Ah, that's true. Although, when I was a kid, I did have a denim one-piece zip-up. Can you believe that a parent would do that?
Do I believe that a parent wouldn't keep that? Is that thing still around?
I don't know.
We need to get that here ASAP.
You
because
need that?
I'm probably your size in high school.
Mm-hmm.
I think that would be a wonderful addition to my wardrobe.
I hated it. It was so hot. It was a denim one-piece.
Oh, it was hot, all right.
Yes, it was. It had a red, white, and blue stripe.
It was American,
it
too?
It was American one-piece denim zip-up.
Stuart, my one request from you in my whole life now and in your whole life mm-hmm. will be if you can find that, just let me know. Send me a little note in the mail.
I think I'm going to try all the way to make it happen.
Because I will wear it and I will put pictures on Instagram. I will go so far as to say that I will make that promise to you, my friend.
You have to wear it and go do a set at the drive-thru liquor store. Is that a deal?
That is a deal. Where is the most unique place you've ever done comedy?
Prison.
Go on.
Yes. I've done three prisons, actually, and they're great. Just like you, I think we might have been talking about this off air, but the thing that you need to know about performing in a prison, you don't pander, you don't judge, you go up and you express yourself and you do your material. They respect you if you respect them. That's it.
Well, yeah, you don't want to get cut, man.
Yeah. I mean, the first prison I did, the two people, the opener and the feature act, just approached it from the worst possible. I mean, the MC was trying to be their buddy. What's up, everybody? And they were looking at him like, are you kidding me? You know? And then the next guy tried to, like, just pretend like he knew what their lives were like. And I went up there and told him, what'd you do to screw up and get in here? And everybody laughed, you know? And then I talked about, you know, whatever I talk about. I didn't change anything. I didn't change any of my material, but they loved it. I just figured, well, let's go up and be me and respect what they do. But I've done two maximum security prisons and one minimum. But so getting cavity searched to do comedy, that shows how much I love this art form.
Mm. Now, how was the cavity search? Were the guards gentle?
Yes. I'm going to say yes because I have very little, thing to actually compare it to. I mean, I'm going to say yes. I've been working on this bit lately about what we don't know. You hear so much about all this. I'm interested right now in what we as humans haven't figured out yet.
Stuart, we know everything. I know everything.
Is
I have
right?
told it to people. They know I know everything.
Is it eight?
No, it's actually three. But I want you to know.
Oh, eight was my favorite number. I was hoping it was eight.
But
it's
love
eight cut in half.
That's right, because I'm infinity cut in half. That's what I do. I don't need the whole thing. I just need half of infinity.
That's
you know what I mean?
That's how good you are?
That's how good I am.
You are a remarkable person. I'll give you that.
Thank you, Stuart. Any other compliments, please send my way. I will tweet those out. Let people know how wonderful I am. Because if anything, I am a man of humility, sir.
You scream humility.
I think my pompadour does. I think people look at the coif and they say, this is a man who certainly knows how to feel the angst of the masses.
People just hug you randomly because they know that you're struggling.
Mm, I get that a lot.
Yeah.
They say this is a man in need of love.
Yeah. You don't have the sign, but you project the sign.
Mm.
Help. Help.
It's interesting what your eyes can say when your mouth won't say it for you. You know, Stuart?
Now, I think George Bernard Shaw did say that.
When he was on his opium bender.
Yeah, not exactly in that text. Yeah, he was on an opium bender.
As one was wont to do back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
I call those the good old days. Those Dr. Quinn, Medicine Woman, and Sully.
Where do we want to wrap this up? What do we? How we
you want to wrap this up already? Wrap
no,
it up
I didn't
before
mean wrap
you tap it up.
It up?
What are you? I mean, what message are
what
you sending to the kids?
What direction do we want to take for this? Do we want to stay high? Do we want to go? Sir,
let's just let this rock and roll, man.
Yeah, you want to just
having,
do it?
We're having a good time.
Okay.
So we're talking about the Confederate flag. Take it down. Leave it up. They lost.
I think that's an important issue. I think that right there, that is a fact that should at least be included in the argument. This is the flag of the losing side. So the fact that it was allowed to be flown on the state buildings is kind of like a very nice thing that the North did. They burned Atlanta to the ground, but they let you fly your loser flag on the building.
As a man from the North, sir, I'm going to say that we are givers.
You are givers.
A lot of people don't know that about us. They think we're cold as ice. Cold as ice. We're loving. We're loving people.
I have found that, you know. I have found that definitely. I was one of my favorite things that's happened to me on the road. I was driving in upstate New York, and I decided to get off the highway, you know, just get on the back road. Let's take a look, you know.
Was it fall? Were you leaf peeping?
Oh, it wasn't quite the leafers season.
Oh, I love some good leaf peeping.
Right, but they were starting to pack the picnic.
Oh, yeah.
It was right at that beginning. So I had the windows down. It was nice outside, and I'm on a back road, and I crest a hill. There is a... I'm going to go with 60-year-old man, overalls, no shirt underneath, no shoes. He was standing on the line in the road, in the dead center of the road, and he had a shotgun leveled at my car. So I hit the brakes, went down into the passenger seat, was thinking, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? What am I going to do? Kept waiting for the blast to hit, you know, and I thought, if I reverse, I'm on a hill, I got to go back. I'm just going to go. I put it in reverse. About the time I click the car into reverse, I turn, he's at my window, and he goes, "Don't worry about it, son. You ain't the son of a bitch I've been looking for. Welcome to New York."
Well, isn't that reassuring?
Isn't it nice? I loved it. I absolutely loved it. My whole body was shaking, but when he said that, I smiled and I said, "I hope you find him." I was like, I love it when stuff like that happens to me. I mean, I'm not crazy about being someone pulling a gun on me, but now that it's over and the adrenaline is gone and I'm safe, what a nice story.
Don't worry, son. You're not the son of a bitch I've been looking for.
Yeah.
Wow. We have dug deep today, sir. I am so glad you've joined us. At this time in the show, we always like to give individuals the opportunity to share a final thought, an open mic, a carte blanche, if you will, to tell the masses what they want to hear.
Oh, what the masses want to hear?
Or what you want to tell them.
Yeah, I don't think I want
to. I like to pander. That's my goal. I just pander away.
Yeah.
Panhandling panderer. If they want to hear it, I'm going to tell it to them.
Okay, I'll have two. We'll divide it into two then.
All right.
Let's do what the masses want to hear. We'll do that first. Bacon bowls are half price at Target.
Woo! I love that.
I think that about sums up what the masses want to hear.
Yeah. Wow, bacon bowls are half price. We might not even have time for the second half after that, Stuart, because...
Show's done.
The show is over.
Bacon bowls, half price.
Half price.
Target. Which brings me to what I want to say. No matter what side politically you're on, can we all agree on one thing? I want one thing. That anger towards a scientific thought, theory, possibility, discovery, something is a ludicrous and ridiculous and pointless emotion. Can we say that? Look, for some odd reason, there's no anger when science invents frozen microwavable blueberry pancakes because it added something to our lives.
You betcha.
But global warming might just make us have to rein things in.
What?
It either exists, human interference in global warming, it either is true or it isn't. We aren't 100% sure yet. Can we at least not get mad until we figure it out?
Well, Stuart, I am not going to get mad. In fact, I am going to be glad that you have been on the show today. Sir, thank you so much for being on.
Thank you for having me. It was a lot of fun.
Well, we, my friends, will be right back right after this.